Millions of Angolans voted today, Wednesday, in polls expected to be the most competitive since the country's first multi-party vote in 1992. President João Lourenço and his main opposition opponent, Adalberto Costa Jr., hoped to win over the youthful and largely poor electorate. VOA correspondent Myra de La Salette is on the ground and will bring us the latest. And in East Africa, Kenya's Raila Odinga challenges the election that gave William Ruto a narrow victory, calling it a do-or-die battle against corruption.
The action we have taken is perfectly in line with the stipulations of our constitution on resolving electoral disputes.
We'll discuss what's next for the two African nations. Straight Talk Africa starts right now. Hello and welcome to Straight Talk Africa. A warm welcome to you. I'm Vincent McCorry in for Haiti Adams. This week we look at the tight presidential election taking place in Angola on Wednesday and the aftermath of the elections in Kenya, where veteran opposition politician Raila Odinga has gone to court to challenge William Ruto's victory. Now, as Angolans voted on Wednesday, millions of youth left out of its oil-fueled booms have expressed frustration with nearly five decades of MPLA rule. Let's take a listen.
I do hope for a lot of changes to happen, for whoever asks for help or needs it. Change will only happen if there are opportunities for the people. So I have a lot of expectations the youth will get more opportunities. I hope that new ideas will also be heard, because there are a lot of young people out there that have great ideas. We just don't get the opportunities.
I am in despair, with no hope for Angola. But even so, I have inside this faith that creates some expectations. So I hope to see one Angola which is built by every single citizen, regardless of one's party, ideology, religion, and so and so. I'd like to see an Angola where every Angolan and every resident can be part of the nation's constructions we are looking for. One of the things that shocks me a lot is seeing little kids going through trash so they can feed themselves and their families.
I can tell you my expectations are dead, because it has been about 46, 47 years since Angola's become independent, and the song playing is the same: make the country and people's lives better. And so far, nothing happened. So I have no good expectations for this country right now.
I have many expectations for Angola's future, but I especially hope the government invests more in training capable people, in developing our culture, because culture is the foundation of every society.
My expectations are not good. Things have stopped evolving since 1975. Policies and rhetoric seem to be the same, and Angola seems to be stagnant and to just hibernate. The country hasn't advanced since 1975 because of those who rule us, or better yet, unrule us. Because of those who allegedly Angola's saviors, the messiahs, but they do nothing different. The only thing we see is that Angola's people live in bad conditions, are victims of kleptocracy due to the bad governance. So my expectations are negative. I see no changes in the future.
Well, there you have it, from the youth and some who are not very old. Well, we're now joined by viewers Myra de La Salette by phone from Luanda, Angola. Good evening, Myra. And first, start by describing to us the voting process today. What did you observe?
Hello, good evening. Thank you for having me. Yes, today was a day that started very, very early. Angolans started going to the polling stations around 5 a.m., even though it only opened at 7 a.m. And a lot of people really heard their leaders, the call to vote. And from the places that we went to, it was we had the opportunity to see a lot of people. The people that we talked with, they were excited about it. They found the voting process an important way for them to contribute for their country. So Angolans really took serious this process this year.
Yes. Now, from what you've heard up to this point, was it a smooth process or were there any places where there were some challenges, especially in the early part of the day?
Yes. So far, it has been a process with not major moments of incidents, but we did get some people denouncing, for example, the civil society movement MUDE. They had some of their workers, they have people around the polling stations to make inquiries. And they did tell us that some of the people that work with them to collect the data, to know who's voting, were arrested. And they say that there was no explanation whatsoever. We have people telling us that their phones were, they were asked to give their phones while they were voting. And there's no law forbidding anyone to have their phones in their pockets. So there's also a little bit of this episode of some officials that work at this polling station not really knowing the laws and trying to impose some rules just because they feel like that's how it should be. So yeah. There's some episodes, not a lot. There's no violence so far, at least. We didn't get any reports. We've been following the National Electoral Commission press conferences throughout the day. They gave two, and there was no report, no official report of any incident so far.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we came to you, we listened to the voices of young people and others not so young expressing their frustration. Was that manifest at the polling stations? What was the turnout like today?
What was there? I'm sorry, Vincent. I think I lost you there.
Very quickly, what was the turnout like? I mean, we saw people saying they don't expect much from this election. But from your observation and from what you're hearing, how was the turnout today?
Oh, it was very good. It was very good. Even though people showed their frustration, they want to see the change that they feel that the country should have. And the lines, the queues at the polling stations were very long, especially in the outskirts of the city.
Mm-hmm. Now, the process ends today. Tell us about what is expected in the coming days. When can we expect to hear the next president announced or declared?
So the law says that the National, the Electoral Commission has up to 15 days to give the final results. Before that, he has about 3 days to give the preliminary results. And after that, there will be a period of time for people, either parties or civil society movements, to contest, to question those results.
Mm-hmm.
In 2017, we did get the results in a week. We didn't go up to 2 weeks. The expectation this year is about the same, is that in a week, the results should be released, the final results. But in 3 days, we might have some kind of idea of who's going to be the next leader of Angola.
Okay. Excellent reporting, Myra. Thank you very much for that report.
Thank you so much.
See you soon.
Thank you.
Well, yeah, now joining us are our guests. We have Claudia Silva, an analyst coming to us via Skype from Luanda, Angola, and Paul Ntuli, specialist in African and China-Africa relations here in Washington. Welcome to both of you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Yeah. Now, first, I want to go to Luanda, and I want to ask you, what was your observation in terms of the turnout and how that actually gels with the whole issue of frustration with this long, many years of poor economic performance, poverty, that has been a source of a lot of frustration to most Angolans.
Before I went to vote today, I had a feeling, based on conversations I've had with people, based on interviews I've had with people, and based on the general mood of the country, that turnout would be high. Especially after we all registered to vote in a process that was very far from being ideal. There was a big push from the government to get people to vote, but the process itself was made to be more complicated than it should have been. There were too few places made available for the vast majority of the public to go register. And then in the end, it didn't even matter if you registered or not, because your name was on the electoral roll anyway. And that's one of the reasons that there are currently about 2 million deceased people actively in the middle in the electoral roll, something that the National Electoral Commission said should not be a problem. But clearly that's going to give us way too high abstention rates, not going to be true abstention rates. I went to vote very early today because I had another interview this morning, so I was there in line before my polling station even opened. But and polling stations were supposed to open at 7 a.m. But my station in particular only opened at 8 a.m. And as time went by, people became more and more frustrated at the fact that there was a 1 hour delay. And when people get frustrated here in Luanda and throughout the country, the immediate scapegoat, rightfully so, is the government and this organization. Yeah. My method of vote to the place where I actually voted was also a little bit disorganized. But the electorate got together and we told the actual delegates, look, if there's four booths, why are you only letting in one person at a time? Let more people in at a time so this process can go a little bit smoother.
Thanks.
And after that, it was all smooth. And it was, like Maida said, it's been a pretty smooth process throughout the city of Luanda, that I know for sure, and throughout the rest of the country.
Yeah.
However, there have been, these delays and these... It's what's come to my attention that not every CNE, National Electoral Commission employee, knows exactly what they're supposed to be doing, and there have been conflicting rules and even made-up rules.
Yeah, it's never completely smooth. Now, Paul Landry here in Washington, the issue of the youth and elections in Africa has become a real significant issue, a big issue. I saw that recently in an election in Kenya. Why is that the issue? Why is that so? And what needs to be done? Because we're getting to hear a lot of disenchantment amongst the youth of Africa.
Well, first of all, Vincent, thank you very much for having me on the show once again. It's always a pleasure to be on Straight Talk Africa. So, yes, the Angolan election, the Kenyan election, other elections we've seen in recent years just underscore one thing, and that is the African continent is essentially a continent of adolescents. This is a continent of teenagers. Okay, over 80-85% of the population is between the ages of 18 and 30. This is the youngest continent in the world. And, young demographic, that youthful demographic, is much more demanding. It's much more demanding than the older cohorts. It demands for greater democracy. It's demanding for greater transparency. It's demanding for greater professionalism on the part of independent institutions. Unfortunately, it is a demographic that is disproportionately affected by unemployment, very high levels of unemployment and poverty. And it is also a increasingly globally mobile population. It is on social media. It is a cohort that sees what's happening with young people in other parts of the world, and they demand the same things. And so what we see in the election in Angola, and indeed the short sections that you played before the show, that frustration of young people should not surprise us. It should not surprise us. I mean, by and large, in many of these elections, young people show up, as Claudio was saying in the studio down in Angola there with you. They show up, they do their civic duty, they cast their vote, they stay in line for hours and hours and hours. And afterwards, they go home and basically helplessly watch their votes being manipulated by the ruling authorities and by ruling elites. And young people are increasingly saying that this is just unacceptable.
Yeah.
So this is really what you're seeing in these elections that we're seeing in Africa of late.
Yeah, which is really undermining the people's confidence in elections and even a belief in the whole process of voting. Now, Claudio, I want to come down to Luanda, and here's an interesting aspect, especially to the polls before the election. They indicated that the ruling party, MPLA, still remains very, very popular. Now, how does somebody explain this in the face of the grinding poverty among the majority of the country's population? And also, even when it comes to all this disenchantment among the young people of Angola, how do you explain that?
The ruling party, MPLA, is so nervous of actual polling being done here in Angola that they ban polls outright, both pre-election polls and exit polls. What has happened here is that I've actually seen only two credible polls done here in the country. One was from Afrobarometer, done in May. Afrobarometer is a Pan-African organization based in Germany. Their polling in May indicated that MPLA had about 29% of the preference of the electorate, compared to 23% or 22% for UNITA, with over half of the respondents not expressing a preference. And that can be for a variety of reasons, such as distrust of polls. The other poll I've seen here is from Movimento Civico Mudei, a civic organization that Maida also mentioned in her reporting, whose work was actually arrested today, probably because they tried to do exit polling. Movimento Civico Mudei has done polling here in Angola in 17 of 18 provinces and in virtually every single municipality since February. So they've done six monthly polls leading up to these elections. And in all their polls, UNITA had a significant advantage over the MPLA. The latest one I saw from July had UNITA at about 52% and MPLA at about 38 to 39%. And over 73% of our population here in Angola is under 30 years old, as Paul has rightly pointed out. Unemployment with the youth population here, hovers around 60%. So this is the election's biggest voting bloc. Yeah.
And
traditionally, yes, go ahead.
Yeah, Claudia, I wanted to say, yeah, about 60% of the youth of Angola are voting for the very first time, that is, if they vote, because we know there's a big chunk also of people are saying they're undecided. What message do you feel, do you hear is resonating with them when it comes to the differences between MPLA and UNITA? And so what kind of where do they tend to lean to when it came to the messaging around this time?
From what I've seen on the streets, from what I've seen on social media, and from talking to people, this isn't really an election between two men. It's an election between two political systems. MPLA obviously was a one-party state. Angola was a one-party state until 1992. And since then, MPLA still retains a complete control over the state apparatus, absolute control over media. And UNITA's message, eloquently put by Adalberto Costa Jr., is that they want to do a complete state overhaul. They want to separate party and state. They want to amend the constitution to reinstate direct presidential elections. Because at the moment in Angola, we select the president and 220 parliamentarians with a single mark on a single ballot paper. UNITA has also promised to implement local elections and to increase investment in healthcare and in education, all towards the aim of creating a better business environment to foster more employment. And from my perception, this message has resonated very strongly with the youth and with the people that will vote for or have voted for UNITA in these elections. And you notice this a little bit too on their political rallies. Mm-hmm. UNITA's political rallies are mostly filled with people between 20 to 30 years old who are quite passionate about the message that's being sold to them.
And indeed, the future, the present and the future really belongs to these young fellows. Paul, Angola went through a very bitter war, and there are scars there, although the younger generation may be reading this in the books. But in terms of the significance of an election like this in the region, how would you describe that? I mean, is this an isolated election, or would you place Angola in a position where the election in that country, the outcome of the election in that country, has some significance for the entire region, or even for that matter, for the continent?
Yes, thank you, Vincent, and thank you, Claudia, for that very incisive analysis. I think the election in Angola is significant. It's significant, and I would say in three key ways. The first is that the population that we're talking about, the population that is voting currently, 60% that you were mentioning, has not experienced the civil war and did not experience that very bitter tension between the MPLA and UNITA, which of course goes back to prior to 1975. These are two movements that were fighting to control the country. And there were many narratives that went around that. UNITA had been portrayed as a movement that was not Pan-Africanist, that worked with the apartheid government in South Africa and so on. But that narrative has melted away. And these young people no longer have that unquestioning loyalty to the types of principles that MPLA has been articulating since 1975, and I think this has resonance. I mean, Angola is not alone in this regard. Southern Africa is a region that is governed by former liberation movements for the most part, and these liberation movements are really at an inflection point in terms of this young demographic that is rising that did not experience the liberation struggle, that did not experience the wars of independence. I think that is the first significance. The second significance is the transformation of UNITA. The transformation of UNITA. UNITA, we've seen, and a lot of opinion pollers have been very surprised as to the inroads that UNITA and this candidate, this young candidate, Adalberto has had a lot of inroads in a lot of areas that were places like Malange, for instance, which have always been MPLA strongholds. And the reason why UNITA has been able to transform itself in this manner is because it has been able to put its finger on the pulse of this demographic that is now emerging. So basically what UNITA is doing, and what UNITA and others, because there are other coalitions as well in Angola that we've not talked about, what they're doing is they're tapping into that constituency, mm-hmm. and they're tapping into that frustration. The third element is the reason why this election is so significant is the state of independent institutions in Angola. And Claudio has just correctly mentioned that the MPLA, it was a very strong Soviet-style system whereby the intelligence, the state apparatus, the military, the armed vigilantes are firmly in control of the ruling party. So this will definitely impact that election.
Wow, I'm really getting to enjoy this conversation, but we want to leave it right here. And I want to thank you, Claudio and Paul, for your insights. Now, Paul is going to stay with us to continue our conversation about another election, this time in East Africa. Now, the citizens of Kenya went to the polls 2 weeks ago. William Ruto was declared president, but opposition leader Raila Odinga is contesting the elections of the country's Supreme Court.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
Kenya's former Prime Minister Raila Odinga is challenging the validity of the results of a closely fought election that saw his rival William Ruto declared president-elect. As the battle moves to Kenya's Supreme Court, political and legal experts weigh in on Odinga's claims of voter fraud. Juma Majanga reports from Nairobi, Kenya.
In the wake of Kenyan elections, current Deputy President William Ruto was declared president-elect after earning 50.5% of the votes. But his main rival, former Prime Minister Raila Odinga, who received 48.9% of the votes, has refused to concede. The fight now shifts to the country's highest court, where Odinga and his Azimio la Umoja One Kenya alliance hope to overturn the results. Odinga is alleging voter fraud, and legal experts say the court will be looking at the evidence.
You must appreciate that to subvert or sabotage the will of the people is both criminal and borders on treason. It is extremely serious. But that is just what is being said on media.
There must be tangible or material discrepancy. The same must be proved satisfactorily, and it must be demonstrated that it would have changed the outcome of the case. If those three ingredients do not line up, then you are unlikely to be successful.
Four of the seven election commissioners, all of them appointed by Odinga ally President Uhuru Kenyatta, have disowned the presidential results by the commission's chairperson, Wafula Chebukati. Lawyers say that will provide impetus to a petition challenging the outcome, even as local observers under the umbrella of Elections Observation Group give the poll a clean bill of health.
When you look at the Constitution of Kenya, the commission means the commissioners. And also the commission can mean the commissioners and the secretariat. But you agree that neither the commissioners nor the secretariat can do anything unless they are assisted by the entire staff. So there's nobody really left out.
We have not seen anything that would warrant a petition of this nature. However, we remain open to the fact that there could be something.
The Kenyan constitution allows anyone to challenge the presidential election outcome at the Supreme Court within 7 days of the announcement of the results. Such a petition will be heard and a verdict issued within 14 days of filing. If the Supreme Court upholds the outcome, the new president is sworn in on the 7th day after the verdict. If the election is nullified, a repeat election is conducted within 60 days after the verdict. Kenyans' views vary about Odinga's decision to challenge the election outcome.
A lot of irregularities and irregularities. Yeah, so we go back to election or we recount it.
We are urging the court this time to give justice. And justice we mean if somebody won the election, just give him his victory. Don't tell us again to go back to elections, because this will be now taking us back.
Kenya has been lauded for conducting a fairly peaceful election so far. As the battle over the validity of the results moved to the highest court, Kenyans are hopeful that peace will prevail. Juma Majanga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Now, to advance the discussion on Kenya's concluded elections and the Raila Odinga petition, I'm joined by, here in the studio, Anita Regan. She's an analyst. And via Skype from Nairobi, Kenya, Paul Mwangi. He's a constitutional lawyer. And Paul Ntuli, as we mentioned earlier, specialist in Africa and China-Africa relations, Washington, D.C., stays with us. And I want to come back. I want to come first to you, Paul Mwangi. And you know, Paul, since 2007, we have seen elections in Kenya being challenged in court, being questioned, and some have associated this with Raila Odinga. We've seen it on the campaign trail where they say he's always rejecting the election results. Someone may want to ask, what is the problem with Kenya and Kenya's electoral systems?
First, we have to understand that elections hold a very central place in Kenyan political life, and they are always very contested, and they're very hot moments in the national life. But we've come very far from where we were, possibly from 1988, when elections used to be a question of lining up behind the person you wanted. And we have developed to the point that one of the least worries today in the way elections are held is not even ballot stuffing. We are now dealing with issues about the use of technology and the kind of problems that are arising, kind of very new age kind of problems regarding the use of technology in elections.
Yes, and I just want to stay with you for a minute, Mr. Mwangi. You know, Raila Odinga, of course, immediately rejected this election. I remember I was there at the Bomas of Kenya when he didn't actually show up when the declaration was being made. Now, from a constitutional point of view, first people said that there was an irregularity when it came to the announcement per se, when it was made by Mr. Wafula Chebukati, the chairman of the IEBC, the electoral body. In a few words, to begin with, is that an issue on its own, how the announcement was made without at least four of the seven commissioners of the IEBC?
That is a very fundamental issue, because the Constitution and the Elections Act are very clear that the presidential election is conducted by the commission. And the chairman of the commission only announces the results that have to be verified and tallied by the commission. The question then comes, who is the commission? Now, we are in a position where Wafula Chebukati, the chairperson, is regarding himself as the sole authority in respect of this election, and disregarding the fact that he has a commission and he has to run this election with that commission. The law also says that the commission must act in unison, and in case that they have a difference of opinion, then they must vote on it. So as we speak, four out of three commissioners have said that these elections are not credible. That would mean that is the position of the commission.
Yeah. Now, Anita, you know, the Kenyans went to the polls, and it was a very smooth process, actually, other than a few delays in the morning. Mm-hmm. I was there, went around some of the polling stations. Everything looked okay. The counting began, and eventually they get to, you know, to get this declaration. And of course, Raila Odinga has disputed that and said there are issues, there are things that happened that shouldn't have happened. It's not just him. We've even seen now Mr. John Githongo, the former anti-corruption czar, you know, saying he has some dossier, which kind of gives the credence to that fact that there was some interference. So from what you hear, from what Kenyans are telling you, how is that to them? How does this sound to them after such a long process that they waited for 5 years to end up again like it ended in 2017 or perhaps even before?
Well, Vincent, we have to be aware that this has been ongoing in Kenyan politics or African politics since 2007. We came again in 2013, again 2017, and 2022. Is there any difference? Every single time there was an outcome of some result, there was someone saying, well, it's not correct. So how do we put enough trust in the commission than the when they do give out results, that they are actually accurate enough for people to accept. And the whole idea of people losing an election should be part of the actual process. Mm-hmm. So in this point, when we have reached where we have in 2022, could they have done it better? Absolutely. But what did they do differently? This information was actually uploaded in the IEBC website, so everyone was able to access it, look at it, and then determine the outcome of the actual results. So whether it was election observers or international monitors, everybody had information to the exact same information, except for those four commissioners. So what did they know? When did they know it? And then what did they do about it?
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, we're going to contest it if everyone is not in agreement on what the rules of the games are from the beginning. But under the Constitution and the Election Act, only Chebukati can announce the results.
And that's where there have been differences. Different legal minds are saying different things. Some say it has to be the commission. There has to be some an agreement amongst the seven plus the chairman. And others are saying, no. The others really are nothing. They don't mean anything. The chairman on his own, he can do the declaration. So I think that's going to be a legal argument, an interpretation of the law and the rules by the smart brains of Kenya, the lawyers. But I want to turn to Paul Nantulia as a person who has been studying these issues also and a keen observer of the Kenyan election. The fact that the same electoral commission that was accused of bungling the last elections conducted the elections, and the same chairman, in fact, who was overseeing the election that was overturned. Now, how does that look to you, even from just the optics of it, but the moral standing of that, that we now get to a point where we're bringing up the same issue, but we allowed the same body, the same chairman, to conduct this election?
Thank you, Vincent. Thank you. Look, that's a very critical question, because you have the same commission, the same commissioner, I would say, who conducted the election this time around. Remember that in 2017, there was an upsurge. Everybody was demanding the resignation and even the punishment by criminal. There was a demand that Mr. Chebukati should face criminal charges because of the manner in which he handled the 2017 elections. What was different this time around? If one looks very closely at this election, it was the legal environment. The legal environment was different. The constitutional environment was different. And this, I think, goes back to the petitions that people like Maina Kiai and others successfully shepherded through the High Court that led to landmark rulings that we haven't seen anywhere else in Africa. For instance, the ruling that results that are announced at the polling station are final. These are final results. The results that are recorded at the polling station cannot be altered in any way by anybody, not even the commission chair. Mm-hmm. That, I think, was landmark, because if you look at what happens in other countries in East Africa, the person of the chairman of that commission has tremendous power to alter results, to even interpret results that are coming in from the polling stations. That power was taken away from the commission. So I think that was a landmark, and it was a first for Kenya, and perhaps even a first for Africa. Mm-hmm. The second is the transparency that even Mr. Chebukati himself was demanding, was encouraging the media, because, of course, these elections, as my sister has rightly pointed out, these results were uploaded on the IEBC server, on the IEBC portal. And the IEBC portal, I mean, I was following, I logged in and I was able to follow these results coming in live. And all media agencies were running these tallies, independent tallies, and began releasing provisional results 72 hours before the IEBC started announcing its own results. Again, this was a first in Kenya, and indeed it was a first in Africa. So I would say that the reason why we saw Mr. Chebukati, the very same person that was under the gun last time, demanding this level of transparency is simply because of those successful petitions that have been introduced in Kenya over the past several years. So it shows that there's been a level of vigilance on the part of civil society in Kenya.
Yeah, quite some progress then. And if we're going to talk about precedent, we'll see about the Maina Kiai issue. I think it has come to the very center of conversation now. But before I come to you, Mr. Paul Mwangi, let's go to the Kenyan opposition leader, Raila Odinga, and let's hear him explain the importance of contesting the elections.
This is a do-or-die battle for the corruption cartels who have everything to lose should the forces of democracy take over. The corruption cartels are prepared to compromise electoral systems, bribe electoral officials, make security systems look other way, or even kill in order to find their way to power and their ill-gotten wealth and continue stealing from the public. We believe this is what happened in this election. For the sake of Kenya's future, the corruption network must not only be stopped, it must also be crushed.
Well, that's Raila Odinga. Now, Mr. Mwangi, here you heard what Mr. Raila has said, and there are, of course, all these interpretations of whether he even has a basis for going to court, but he explains why this is important to him. Now, as a constitutional lawyer, what do you have to say to that?
First, let me correct the wrong impression that these results were coming in line, because that is one of the major contestations where we have found out that documents that were being loaded into the IEBC portal were not coming directly from the kids, Kim's kids that were being used in the field. Results would first come in and land on a separate platform before they are loaded up. And we have come up with forms that are very substantially different from what has been on the ground. So it is quite erroneous for this election to be given a clean bit of health on the basis that elections were being done live. The problem we have now is that we feel as if everybody wants to tranquilize us so that we accept and say that this was good enough and we'll try it next time. But where Kenya is today is that the real voter turnout was just about 50%. And young people are not voting. People are not interested in elections anymore. Elections are beginning to lose their legitimacy. And I do not know what is going to happen in the next election, but we are headed to a place where the younger people will never come out to vote unless somebody stands up now and insists that things must be done the right way.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're tuned to Straight Talk Africa, and we want to take a break, a short break right now, and we'll be right back.
So having in mind that there is a team that went to the Supreme, it also a mirage to the Kenyan democracy, because definitely it will create a milestone when it comes to other elections because of the outcome of the judgment of the Supreme. So I know based on the outcome of the Supreme, we are going to have a defined way of how elections will be conducted in Kenya going forward. It is a success for us as youth because we have been peaceful and we will continue being peaceful. And I know basically of the outcome of the Supreme, what I can tell to the people that went there. Whatever the outcome will be, let us take it.
Well, and indeed, that's what I heard from a great number of people. They believe that the court system should be allowed to work. So for those who are rubbishing the whole question of petition, a great number of Kenyans also say, let's see what the court system says. I mean, how the court process takes place. Now, Paul Nantulia, indeed, as Mr. Paul Mwangi says there, there were actually, and there are still talks about the possible manipulation of the system way before you get to the Form 34B, that in fact, as transparent as it looked, it was also possible that some people may have gone in and it altered the numbers that were being put in the portal. And that makes it harder sometimes, of course, to prove the case, because it's like the process was messed up before it was put in this portal, in which an argument can be made that you cannot change anything that has been fed into the portal. Now, does that kind of make it challenging for Mr. Raila Odinga, or does that again erode even further the IEBC credibility?
Yes, no, thank you, Vincent. And I would like to thank my the other Paul for mentioning that, for mentioning his concerns. Because democracy moves in fits and starts. It is never a straightforward process. It is a process that evolves incrementally. And certainly this has been the experience in Kenya, where I grew up. I grew up under that one-party state where you saw as a child, you saw people lining up and you're like, oh, this is what elections mean. This is what democracy means. And then come in multi-party politics, 92, 97, you know, you're starting to become a young man and you're looking at this and you're like, oh, but why are people challenging President Moi? Because I thought that people are supposed to lead for life. And then you then begin to get socialized into that process. And basically, I mean, when I look at where the processes are today and I look at where the processes were in 1992, it's a world of a difference. I mean, Maina Kiai, for instance, was lectured me at university. And many other people who used to come to speak, Kivutha Kibwana and all these people that were struggling for democracy, Feroz Norwoji. And I remember they used to come and they used to basically say, you know, this is a model. This is a model of what an election should look like. First of all, the Electoral Commission needs to be independent and they need to be constitutional provisions. Secondly, the polling stations, the results need to be done at the polling station and so on. And I remember as students, we used to say, wow, this is pie in the sky. This can never happen in Kenya. But lo and behold, it has happened. So, but that does not mean that there are no problems. And I think this is where the Supreme Court ruling will be extremely important. Because regardless of the decision the Supreme Court takes, the Supreme Court can criticize certain aspects of the election that were not proper and can order additional protections to beef up the Maina Kiai proposals. So I think this is where I'm looking at. This is what I'm looking at.
Yes, Paul. Thank you. I want to come to the studio here. Anita, you know, the gentlemen are talking about, of course, Paul Nantulia saying the Kenya is growing, you know, gradually. The space is expanding. The electoral processes are kind of getting improved so far. Now, there are those who make the case, and I think Paul alluded to that Mr. Raila's petitions in court have actually helped refine the electoral processes. Mm-hmm. So how should this be viewed, this current petition? Whether it wins or not.
This is right. Right. The Constitution says if you do have a problem and you're opposing, it's your right to go and petition the court to address your grievances. Absolutely. But all systems do have their critics. Let us be clear. No matter what we do, there's going to be critics, you know, talking about these issues one way or another. But one thing we have to see, what has happened from 2007 to date? From 2017 to date, IABC has not really been given the resources, the financing they needed to talk about exactly now what we are now not trusting them to do. They did not have the money. They only had 3 members in the IABC. They didn't have a quorum until 7 months ago when they got the new 4 commissioners who just joined in the IABC. So at the end of the day, if you do not give them the resources that they need for the past 5 years, then you nominate another 4 who just come into the system, how do you expect them to operate with limited resources? And are they professional enough to know what it is that they were supposed to do or why they're in those positions? Because being in those positions require an understanding of what you're required to do. But they have to work as a team, right? Yeah. And if the team is, Mr. Chepukati is the chair and he's the returning officer who can only announce, then everybody else cannot set that whole process aside and do what they want to do. Mm-hmm. So we need to understand what it is that we're asking the IABC to do, first of all, but also give them the resources they need for them to be able to function as a commission.
Okay. Now, Mr. Paul Mwangi, there are 2 issues here that I would like to raise with you. First, there is the whole question of whether it was regular, the way Mr. Chebukati announced this election. Of course, that is a point you've made there. But the question is that the biggest problem, or is it, in fact, the way the whole process was conducted? And you've mentioned that there might have been manipulation in the process. There might have been interference in the system. So was that a systemic problem which gave a loophole to some crafty fellows to go in? Or can that be perceived to be a scheme that was actually fronted by Mr. Chebukati himself? And I don't know how the legal argument is going to be at the Supreme Court.
First, let me say, like what Anita is saying, this is actually the first time I've ever had this election having problems on the issue of finances. There has been no issue of financing, and Chebukati has had all the money he has needed to run this election. But the question about the culpability, it seems to be a scheme that Chebukati himself was running. When the elections were coming up, he asked IEBC to allow some of our observers to go to Greece to supervise, to witness the printing of the ballots. While we were there, we found out that Chebukati had ordered a parallel system of Form 34As, different from the ones that he intended to use, which were going to offer an alternative method of reporting of results. Secondly, we also found out that he had refused to order a security printed Form 34B, which is an issue we took up with him when he came here. He promised then that they would instruct all returning officers to ensure that they did not use the parallel Form 34As. Of course, that never happened. And this is the parallel reporting system that we are seeing. Hmm. But other than that, there are also questions of the mathematics. These mathematics simply don't add up. You have results being transferred direct from 34As, but by the time they get to from 34C, there are additions that you cannot explain. And so far, we have come up with about 217,000 votes, just out of arithmetic errors of the transfer of votes from 34A to 34C. And the margin here that we are supposed to have lost with is 230,000. So you can see how incredible that is.
Now if I may stay with you, please. There have been questions. If indeed the Azimio or even ODM has had issues with the Electoral Commission since the last election and in the previous election, what did Mr. Raila Odinga and others who really wanted to have a good, credible elections do for the 5 years prior to this election to make sure that there will be an outfit that can hold, conduct an election that will be accepted at the end of the day?
Well, unfortunately, is that Wafula Chebukati does have security of tenure. We tried in every way to have that reformed. We presented petitions to parliament that were not successful. We tried to amend the constitution to bring in new laws to guide the electoral system. Again, that was not successful. So in very many ways, there what we could have done was not possible. And what we are left with now is to be vigilant as to how the election was being conducted, which we have been, and that is how we've been able to expose this criminal enterprise.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, Anita, you know, a lot is going to be said later as we observe this election go on, but I mean this petition go on. But of course, Mr. Paul Mwangi is saying first, the challenge has been security of tenure for the chairman himself, and of course, finances were not an issue. Now, in terms of the craftiness, this, you know, the messing up of the election, is it possible, from your assessment, from your you know, knowing how things have been happening, actually, that there could have been an infiltration, which may not necessarily go all the way to the top, but that the chairman did not, at the end of the day, address the concerns of the parties like the Azimio coalition that raised concerns before this process ended?
Of course, as I said before, all systems will have its critics. We could do things better, absolutely. But if we were to do things differently, how would we do it? We do not wait until before an election to start now talking about these issues. These are issues that need to be worked on from the last election for it to be able to have some effect on the outcome that people want to have. But an opinion poll does not guarantee you the result that you want. Mm-hmm. And then in addition to that, we also have to look at the numbers. Before, we had 22 million registered voters going to the polls. Now we had 14 million registered voters. So what happened to those 8 million voters? Well, okay, that is something that also I have to look into.
Yeah.
And then the areas where you say Honorable Odinga won, he did not win as many as he did when it came to 2017. The numbers are also different. So we also have to look at other moving parts in an election. As to oppose, always to look at the result. Yeah. We also have to look at what happened in each county, look at the numbers, and see whether they are what they say that they are, first of all.
And just because of the number issue, Paul Nantuli, you said you were in the portal, you're looking at everything, but of course, there have been issues raised about that. For the sake of transparency, you know, at the end, the other commissioners said, the four commissioners who disavowed those results said they needed to have sat down with the chairman to really consult over some of the issues that had been raised. Was that a big a major failure there by the chairman? He needed to just sit down with the commissioners and square out things?
Well, possibly, because in Kenya, like the previous petition where the Supreme Court overturned the election, they overturned the election on the basis that the processes did not strictly conform to constitutional requirements. So I guess that's the reason why Raila Odinga's side has gone to the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court should be able, I mean, it does have the competence, and it has been able to show through previous rulings, such as the one in 2017, and recently when the Supreme Court stopped the Building Bridges Initiative, upheld the decision by the High Court to stop that initiative in its tracks. It should be able to rule on that. Three things: eternal vigilance on the part of civil society, as Maina has pointed out. Paul Maina has pointed out. Number two, petitions rather than violence, which is one other thing that we've seen. And number three, historical precedent, like my sister Anita has pointed out. I think Kenya has been able to set historical precedents.
Thank you.
It's not perfect, yeah. But I think it's a work in progress.
Thank you. And indeed, we cannot exhaust this conversation. On that note, our guests have been Anita Regan, Paul Mwangi, constitutional lawyer, and Paul Nantuli. Thanks to our audience for tuning in to Straight Talk Africa. That's it. It's been great.